This will be the next to last installment of Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America by Leonard Peikoff. It's from Chapter 14, America Reverses Direction. And it starts with a quote by Charles R. Van Hise, president of the University of Wisconsin and a spokesman of the progressive movement, 1910. He who thinks not of himself primarily, but of his race and of its future, is the new patriot. From Rexford G. Tugwell, New Deal Brain Truster, 1935, we are turning away from the entrusting of crucial decisions to individuals who are motivated by private interests. From JFK in 1961, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Mark Rudd, I remember him well, New Left Student Leader, 1970. We think that the duties of a revolutionary transcend his individual wants. That's why in our collectives we fight individualism at every point. And finally, Irving Kristol, neoconservative intellectual, is that right? 1972. Self-government, the basic principle of this republic, is inexorably being eroded in favor of self-seeking, self-indulgence, and just plain aggressive selfishness. And now to the text. America, as conceived by the founding fathers, lasted about a century. Leonard, you're wrong there, too. There were contradictions, government controls of various kinds, from the beginning. But for a century, the controls were a marginal element. No, they weren't, Leonard. The dominant policy endorsed by most of the country's thinkers was individualism and economic laissez-faire. That is true, but that has nothing to do with the fact that we still live on the freaking plantation. Because Peikoff doesn't get it either. And back then, you know, okay, fine. He still doesn't get it. As we move into the text, the turning point was the massive importation of German philosophy in the period after the Civil War. No. The first consequence increasingly manifest in the post-war decades was the proliferation of statist movements in this country. The new statists included economists who adopted the organic collectivism of the German historical school, sociologists and historians who interpreted Darwin according to the social ideas of Hegel, in parentheses, the reform Darwinists, in a parentheses, clergymen who interpreted Jesus according to the moral ideas of Kant, okay, in parentheses, the social gospelers, in a parentheses, single taxers who followed Henry George, utopians who followed Edward Bellamy, revolutionaries who followed Marx and Engels, humanitarians who followed Comte, and the later John Stuart Mill, pragmatists who followed William James and the early John Dewey. In essence, it was a single growing trend, which by the turn of the century had mushroomed into a national crusade of the avant-garde intellectuals. The American system, the crusaders said, is morally wrong. It must be reformed in accordance with a nobler vision of life. Novelist William Dean Howells offered a name for the new vision, Altruria. He called the ideal society in his utopian novel of 1894, The Land of Altruism. The first target of the reformist campaign was business, which it was claimed had too much power. The authors of this claim made no attempt to discover what part of such power derived from the operation of free market factors and what part from the growing policy of special government favors to certain business interests, in parentheses, favors such as subsidies, protective tariffs, and monopolistic franchises. The reformists did not believe that any such analysis was necessary. They knew what was right and wrong, and that business by its nature was wrong. They knew it from God or from feeling. Christianity means cooperation and the uplifting of the lowliest, stated one social gospeler. Business means competition and the survival of the strongest. The reformists also knew that there was only one sure method by which to implement their code of right and wrong. Quote, private self-interest, explained the new economists, is too powerful or too ignorant or too immoral to promote the common good without compulsion. The philosophical pragmatists in the 1880s and 90s were pioneering the method of eroding the nation's founding ideas under cover of verbal fealty to them. The reformists followed this lead. Legislation controlling big business, they told the public, would represent not an attack on American systems, but a means of preserving individualism, freedom, and real competition. It is true, economist Richard Eli admitted, that more state action might, quote, lessen the amount of theoretical liberty, end of quote. But he added it would, quote, promote the growth of what, of a practical liberty, Let me slaughter that again. But he added it would promote the growth of practical liberty. As this remark suggests, Richard Ely was a follower of Hegel. He was also a teacher of Woodrow Wilson. The businessmen and their intellectual defenders try to stave off the assault. Businessmen, they declared, must be left free of government controls in order to be able to function successfully and thus achieve their proper end, serving the public welfare. Now, you understand how wrong that is right now, okay? And this is what I go back and forth about as to how the government can get off asking men and women to sacrifice their lives for some kind of great good or the protection of this country, which was never in danger before. Actually, it was about to start war so that, obviously, financiers and industrials can make money. So they ask us to be patriots. They ask us to be patriotic. And that's when they usually want to suck more money out of us or send our asses off to get killed. But corporations who give birth here, and whom, from what I've seen since the 70s, have left this country simply because they don't want to pay the wages here, but they want to bring their products back to be bought by people who really couldn't buy those products if they were paid the wages of the slave laborers these corporations have gone off to employ. So where is it that the corporations don't get to be patriotic? How come America, which birthed some of these companies, can't grab by the back of the neck and say, your ass, you ain't going across the sea? Well, you can't do that. Well, hey, it's life. But you see the dichotomy? You're asked to shed blood, get a leg or eye blown off, out, or whatever, because the country demands you to be patriotic so you can defend the plantation against mostly imagined enemies. But corporations, as we speak right now, are outsourcing jobs despite the fact that we have massive unemployment, most of which I think, well, I'm going to say most of it, I can't defend that, but a great deal of it has just disappeared. You ever see how they check? You ever see how they check to see what the employment's like? Really scientific. Take a look around you, wherever you are. You'll understand how bad things are. These jobs aren't coming back. These companies aren't coming back. What's being pulled off right now is a further colonialization of this country, turning us into third worlders, and nobody says anything. You know, everybody on the mainstream media and that freaking Amy Goodman, that piece of shit in Democracy Now, excuse me, but is no better off. Democracy Now, which is Amy Goodman now. That is Democracy Now, knocking down a cool 80. And that's just cash. They can't figure out how this is all happening. We are being systematically eviscerated and mutilated. And nobody can figure it out. They just rather blame Republicans and Democrats when you don't realize you're being screwed and you have been screwed ever since the inception of this country. There's been more freedom. There's been a decent livelihood for most people in America, but not all. I shouldn't go into a screed about this, but I mean, I'm so sick and tired of listening to intellectuals tell me what it's about when it's bullshit. Academia and all these creatures that are on mainstream media, and you're, oh, they really got it right. NPR and PBS, which are even bigger bought out, are even more oil-soaked. They just don't call it advertising. They call it underwriting by the Pew Foundation. Kiss my ass. Dumbasses. And everybody goes running around in universities who think they got it down because they heard NPR last night. You idiots. At least you're smart enough to know the mainstream is crooked, but you're not smart enough to know that the NPR and PBS is crooked. You can't find an honest newspaper. Anyone who's listening to this hasn't even been alive when newspapers actually had a little bit of a free hand in what they could do because they weren't tied into corporate advertising to keep themselves going. When papers couldn't run on subscriptions any longer, they had to go out and get some money. And when those corporations decided they didn't like what was being done, they choked the free press. So I have to laugh when I listen to all these shows and everybody's saying, well, you know, the economy of the left and the progressive right central, die, freaking die. You know, this is all for people who want to sound like they really, you know, it's like Charlie Tuna, you know. You want people to think you have good taste, so you watch all this crap, you read all this crap, which is nothing. It's an absolute matrix. It's information predicated on a world that doesn't exist. So, and I'm sorry to say this, folks, but you know what? Carlin had it right. Most of you aren't even aware of who's sticking a big red, white, and blue dick up your ass. But you Republicans, blame it on the Democrats. And you Democrats, blame it on the Republicans. And in the meantime, they're laughing their asses off because they're pushing this legislation through, which is more and more pulling a noose tighter around your neck. But as long as you keep fighting with the other party and the other partisans, you'll never know. And what? And I tell you what, it's sickening to have to watch. It isn't that hard. It really is simple, folks. It's really simple. We live in a matrix. We've been propagandized. And as I've said before, the problem with Americans is they're propagandized into believing they can't be propagandized. Yeah, we're the same. Get it right, okay? We're the same as Russia. We're the same as Germany. We're the same as any other country who puts out their shit. But no, we're smarter here. No, you're not, you dumbheads. Jesus. Yes, yeah, right. So you leave government alone and they're going to go ahead and serve the public welfare. Have you seen that happen? Hello? Have you seen that happen? What, J.P. Morgan and Verizon just sent out how many jobs outsourced to the Philippines? People are needing jobs here and they don't get them. Why? Because they don't want to pay people like, I don't know, 10 bucks an hour, which now is a laugh. Yeah, they're really doing a great job. And they were birthed here. My point is, if you take it out, take your ass out of here too. Don't bring your products back. Tell Verizon, start something else up. Make Milton Bradley games. And right now, by the way, Verizon is just absolutely salivating over the prospects of really creating a major monopoly. But why should they be any different? All right, here we go. Sorry. I'm not sorry. The view that unrestricted freedom is necessary to business functioning provoked heated debate among economists. The debate was technical and largely unheeded by the public. The view that businessmen are social servants provoked no debate. On this point, everyone was in agreement. The rich man should administer his surplus revenues so as to proceed, to produce, yeah, I know, I got blood in my eyes, sorry, man. For that, I am sorry. So as to produce the most beneficial results for the community, the man of wealth thus becoming the mere agent and trustee for his poorer brethren, declared multimillionaire industrialist Andrew, we will fuck you up the ass, Carnegie, an enthusiastic follower of Herbert Spencer in 1889. This is Carnegie, who made sure that hemp was demonized, not because it would drive you crazy if you smoked dope, but because it was a natural fiber and he had patents on at least what? Rayon and maybe nylon too, and he wanted those synthetics on the market. That's why grass is demonized. Well, it's a starter drug. No, this is the starter drug, folks. Beer and alcohol. But that's okay, it's legal. Carnegie said in a subsequent letter, and quote, ideal commonwealth, end of quote, may emerge and, quote, deal with the prevention of immense fortunes when the masses become truly educated and the few become less selfish. Oh, God. Give me a barf bag here, will you? Let me get this nearby so I can puke close to me. I'm not in the mood today. Contrary to the Marxist theory, big business has been one of the least influential groups in American history. Most businessmen brushed aside the realm of ideas or echoed passively the ideas of their own worst enemies. Carnegie and his fellow industrialists were struggling to save a political system opposed to the West's new ideological trend, while part-evading, part-appeasing that trend. With each moral pronouncement they issued, these men were strengthening the power of their adversaries. From the outset, the result of this kind of contest between reformists and conservatives was no contest. In 1887, the Interstate Commerce Commission Act established the first federal regulatory body to supervise railroad rates. That's how it came about. Yeah, that worked out real well with John D. Rockefeller and Morgan. This was the prelude to the top legislative triumph of the 19th century reformists, the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. Are you serious? The latter made a sweeping grant of power to the national authorities to punish a newly proclaimed economic crime indicated only in vague, undefined language. In parentheses, restraint of trade. End of parentheses. In principle, the Sherman Act represents the landmark beginning of government control over the economy in America. In parentheses, in practice, such control was minimal until after the turn of the century. End of the parentheses. Let me tell you right now, the Sherman Antitrust Act and all of Teddy Roosevelt's fist pumping and all this bit about carrying a big stick and being a, what was he, a trust buster, was bullshit. What they did was they brought the government in at the behest of the robber baron families who were the ones who created a monopoly. And they decided, okay, why don't we start some kind of legislation so nobody could ever come after us. Not, I mean, government authorities, but that no competition could catch them because the way they got to the top could never be done again. You see that? You got that right? And it was Philander Knox who undid anything that even seemed anywhere beneficial to free enterprise. There's never been a free market, man. That's all bullshit, too. Okay? So that Sherman Antitrust Act was great for headlines. In essence, it did nothing except make sure that nobody could catch the horses that were already out of the barn. Oh, God almighty. This is why, this is when Peacock gets me ill. All right, where are we now? Henry Demarest Lloyd, a leader of the antitrust movement, named the base of the new approach to government. The principle of self-interest, he said, is one of historic mistakes of humanity. What America needs, he said, is a system in which no man will have a right to do with his own what he with his own system. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm pissed. You know, it's not cool that I'm in this mode, but that's just the way it is. So let me read this shit again. The principle of self-interest, he said, is one of historic mistakes of humanity. Like they ever end? What America needs, he said, is a system in which no man will have a right to do with his own what he will, but only a right to do what is right. What the hell does that mean? What kind of bullshit is that? What America needs, he said, is a system in which no man will have a right to do with his own what he will, but only a right to do what is right. Oh, God. A century earlier, the country's leaders had fought a war against England on the premise that individual rights are, quote, what is right. Yeah. Guess again. In 1883, sociologist Lester F. Ward, a reformed Darwinist, there's no such thing as a reformed Darwinist, gave the modern intellectual's answer to Thomas Jefferson. The individual, Ward said, has reigned long enough. The Antitrust Act was passed by a conservative Republican Congress. Many members supported the measure as a political gesture, a device to quiet popular concern, which had been aroused by the reformist campaign. Congress must pass the law, Sherman predicted direly and without foundation, or be ready for the socialist, the communist, and the nihilist. Nothing in the debates on the Sherman Act, observes one historian, suggests that Congress anticipated its vigorous enforcement. Well, I'll give them that much. It's true. The factors involved in the passage of the early regulatory acts indicate the pattern operative in all the turning points of the subsequent decades. Insistent, philosophically generated pressure from the left inaugurates each new development. Popular confusion permits the anti-statist nation of the Enlightenment to accept new increments of state power, one at a time, without any idea of the trans-intellectual sources or meaning. Conservative default, moral and political, leaves the public permanently disarmed. In the 1890s, the main source of the pressure on a national scale was the Populist Party, a group of discontented farmers who took up the ideas of several radical reformists. The party, which demanded such policies as deliberate inflation, a graduated income tax, and full government control of the railroads and trusts, was only slightly ahead of its time. From 1900 to 1917, its heir and successor dominated the nation's top leadership, intellectual and political, Democratic and Republican. The heir was the progressive movement. For the most part, the leading spirits of the progressive era were men who had been students here or abroad in the 1880s or 90s. They were the voices of the first American generation to be reared in college on the new collectivist theories. They were men trained to the conviction that an increase in the power of the state is the solution to most of mankind's problems. These men turned the ideas of their avant-garde professors into an enduring American orthodoxy. In this endeavor, jurists, historians, economists, and best-selling novelists fought side by side along with the settlement house social workers who deplored mass poverty. Excuse me, muckraking journalists who denounced the profit motive, presidents who denounced malefactors of great wealth, in parentheses, Theodore Roosevelt, and progressive educators who denounced the mind. All right, so all these had sided together, okay? The jurists, the historians, yeah, the economists, the novelists, you know, the muckraking journalists, the presidents, and all this stuff, right? All these men and movements preached the prerogatives of the poor and the weak, whom they described as the victims of big business. They demanded a new approach to social questions, an approach eloquently characterized by Herbert, now, get me right on this, the name is C-R-O-L-I. Shall we call him what, Crowley or Crowley or Crowley? Let's call him Crowley, as in trolley. Crowley was an editor and co-founder of the New Republic and an advisor to Theodore Roosevelt. The promise of American life is to be fulfilled, not merely by a maximum amount of economic freedom, but by a certain measure of discipline, not merely by the abundant satisfaction of individual desires, but by a large measure of individual subordination and self-denial. That's from Crowley. Herbert Crowley was the son of a leading American disciple of Auguste Comte's positivism. He was also a philosophy student at Harvard under the Hegelian Josiah Royce. Positivism, Comte had explained, places itself, quote, at the social point of view, and therefore cannot tolerate the notion of rights, for such notion rests on individualism. Individualism, Royce was teaching his students, is the sin against the Holy Ghost. And he writes on, the national government must step in and discriminate. But if it must discriminate, not on behalf of liberty and the special individual, but on behalf of equality and the average man. The average man at the time was struggling to enter this country in order to find sanctuary from governments around the globe, eager to step in and discriminate. He was struggling to enter the fabled land of abundance, where all men, including the poorest, were enjoying a standard of living surpassing that of their counterparts anywhere in the world. But the progressives were not a movement of average men. They had a different view of life. By himself, declared Frank Norris and Theodore Dreiser and the other naturalists of the period, man has no choice and no chance. He is a helpless social product doomed to poverty and despair. His only hope is the government. Organized labor was not making radical demands. In contrast to European workers who were in the vanguard of a class struggle and of the socialist movement, American workers, like the American people, continued to reflect the influence of the Enlightenment. American labor leaders upheld labor's independence and resisted any form of paternalism. The progressives were undeterred. This is a quote from Woody Wilson. The program of a government of freedom must in these days be positive, not negatively merely. Freedom today, Woody said, is something more than being let alone. Yeah, you ought to know, Woody. You let the income tax in, you let the Federal Reserve in, and you got us into World War One. You remember that war, Woody? The war you pledged to keep us out of? But after you got in for the second term, guess what? You got us in it, baby. Because you don't have a set of balls either, just like all the other presidents that are up there. How they can speak in octaves other than soprano, I have no idea. Laissez-faire is not an absolute, explained Oliver Wendell Holmes, and it's not inherent in the Constitution. You got that right. Social needs must be supreme over all laws and abstract principles, however venerable. The Constitution is not sacrosanct anyway, added historian Charles Beard. It merely reflects the selfish desire of the Founding Fathers to protect their own property holdings. Bingo! Charlie's right. That is exactly right. Let me read it again. The Constitution, according to Charles Beard, it merely reflects the selfish desire of the Founding Fathers to protect their own property holdings, and that's the reason why they drafted it. That's why they threw the Articles of Confederation, pimples and bumps and all, out the window and brought this sucker in what, 3 days? Yeah, and church bells were ringing all over the land when they did that, when most everybody there, especially those who had fought supposedly to get our freedom, was like, we didn't fight for that. Why did you do that? Shut up, you don't know what's good for you. And by the way, you can't vote unless you have a couple of acres. Let's go. Okay. Reality is a social product, said the pragmatist. Logic itself is in continual flux. Why should politics be any different? Let us not hesitate but experiment now, said all these voices. The essence of man is not primarily intellect, but action. Here we go, as we tilt into Nazism. The progressives did not hesitate to name the model of their action. The model was the mother country of the leading progressive state, Wisconsin. Wisconsin was described at the time as being fundamentally a German state, which was doing for Germany what Germany is doing for the world. In Germany, perhaps more than any other place, said the New England humanitarian Jane Addams, the government has come to concern itself with the primitive essential needs of its working people. Shall a democracy, she asked, be slower? The result of the progressives' ideas was a wave of new measures and policies in this country, including labor laws which specified working conditions and maximum hours, a compulsory system of workmen's compensation, the regular use of the Sherman Act to prosecute businessmen, legislation forbidding unfair competition, the Clayton Act, a major new regulatory agency, the Federal Trade Commission, and government entry on an unprecedented scale into such fields as finance, the Federal Reserve Act, conservation, food and drugs. To administer and pay for the foregoing, two additional factors, long familiar in Europe, appeared here for the first time. A large entrenched civil service and, after 1913, you got it, a graduated income tax, which, by the way, folks, if you look it up, is one of the 10 planks in the manifesto of the Communist Party. In Europe, the status intellectuals, in harmony with the continent's basic philosophic tradition, could afford to be ideologically outspoken. In America, their counterparts could not afford it. Characteristically, Following the pragmatists, they reach progressive ideas and then presented each new governmental measure as a product not of ideology but of limited practical factors without wider implications. At the same time, they continue to offer ideological reassurances to the nation. There must be a partial substitution of collectivism for individualism, said Theodore Roosevelt in 1913. Not to destroy, but to save individualism. So, that's beautiful. Isn't that great? Never mind. So, in other words, to save individualism, you have to cut into it with collectivism. That makes perfect sense to me, Teddy. Bully for you. In Europe, the rise of statism has been accompanied by the rise of an aggressive nationalism. The same combination of policies was evident in the American reformist movement. And in parentheses, the best-known example is Theodore Roosevelt, the first major opponent of capitalism to occupy the presidency, who united zeal for trust-busting with ardent militarism. Well, one, he couldn't give a shit less about busting trusts, and he was told it was time to cut the American military loose on its pan-military agenda. Or he would wind up like who? McKinley, for whom he was vice president, who didn't play ball. And, as he would well remember, for Garfield, who wouldn't play ball. Oh, they were all lone gunmen. They just pick out certain people. Man, I don't think there's any better batting average than supposed lone gunmen killing presidents. The only ones they missed, I would say, would be Buchanan. Hard to say about FDR because they killed the mayor of Chicago who was sitting right next to him in that motorcade. Don't know about that one. And Reagan. Okay, the two policies were complementary. Each involved a major growth in the power of the central government, and each rested on appeals to the ethics of social service. Parentheses, at home to the poor, abroad to the backward peoples. End of parentheses. The spirit of imperialism, observes American historian R.E. Osgood, was an exaltation of duty above rights, of collective welfare above individual interest. Imperialism in the New World had further, deeper roots. It was difficult to defend such a policy by reference to reason. It was easy by reference to will. American imperialism, adds Osgood, like its European model, also exalted, quote, the heroic values as opposed to materialism, action instead of logic, the natural impulse rather than the pallid intellect. End of quote. When 1914 came, the country did not wish to pursue the heroic values as opposed to materialism. But a group of determined intellectuals, religious leaders, and politicians did wish it. This group, which prevailed over an anti-war public, included in time almost all the leading progressives. President Wilson, in his war message to Congress, observed that the United States had no selfish ends to serve in entering the war. No, they were for every other freaking banker and industrialists. Yeah, okay, I'll leave it alone. Herbert Crowley said that entering the war would provide America with the tonic of a serious moral adventure. Is that what you call it? Oh, man. These are the assholes who never have to go to war. They just sit there and cheer from the stands, way away from the action. He warned his countrymen of the real danger of national disintegration if the average man should elevate having his own way above national service. Achtung, baby, Achtung. After the war, the progressive movement faded. Its political legacy, however, which included many wartime controls, never repealed despite the armistice, endured. The progressivists started America moving in a new direction. They had taken the first major steps toward the establishment of a welfare state. Culturally and politically, World War I was the turning point. It marked the end of the individualist era throughout the West. Although Americans yearned in 1920 to go back to normalcy, there was not to be normalcy again. Normalcy, to them, meant a civilized world which respected man's rights. And its consequences, international harmony, lasting peace, a continually rising standard of living, unobstructed freedom, cheerful self-confidence, hope for the future. Instead, the country faced the aftermath of a global breakdown, the mushrooming of European dictatorships, the growing fear that the selfless crusade of 1917 had been a senseless slaughter, the growing claims of men's duty to their neighbors, and the newer claim of America's duty to the world. The response of all this was a binge of giddy, gin-soaked escapism. The last of the 19th century defenders of laissez-faire were gone. The schools and colleges were not turning out replacements. Although progressivism had faded, its major cultural ally was flourishing. The 20s marked the emergence of progressive education as a national force. For the first time, the ideas of the new educators gained a mass base, spreading beyond a comparatively small vanguard to engulf the children of the middle class. Increasingly, the children were hearing more about feelings and less about objective reality. They were also hearing more about social responsibility and less about the country's past. A generation was losing the knowledge of what the American system had originally been. At the same time, the avant-garde, led by a group of expatriates, was introducing a similar perspective into the arts. It was presiding over the first major eruption in America of the modernist revolt against objectivity in the 19th century. Obediently imitating their old world mentors, fawning over continental decadence while cursing the Philistine Americans, the Pound-Elliott-Stein axis and its equivalents in other arts were turning out free verse, stream of conscious novels, expressionist plays, abstract paintings, non-intelligible forms, non-graspable symbols, obscurity as a means of bourgeois baiting, obscurity offered as spirituality. Here goes Leonard again. Obscurity for its own sake. He's on a roll. The artists said they were bored by life in the United States. They found European manifestations they could admire. The work of Paul Klee boasted the newly founded Museum of Modern Art during the painter's American debut in 1930. It makes the flesh creep by creating a specter fresh from a nightmare. Okay. America was still decades away from the cultural condition of Germany. At one time, however, the distance between them would have had to be measured in light years. The conservative Republicans in the 20s made their own contributions to the trend. Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover, whom people took to be advocates of capitalism, accepted without challenge and thus effectively removed from the field of controversy all the president-setting controls of the progressive era. In addition, while continuing the longtime practice of dispensing federal favors to business, they gradually introduced new status measures of their own. As early as 1919, Herbert Hoover, for instance, rejected laissez-faire in favor of an undefined progressive middle way between socialism and anarchism, damn it. As Secretary of Commerce under Harding and Coolidge, Hoover supported several regulatory innovations involving government agencies to control the air transport and radio industries. You see where we're going here, right? This is also called the Sovietization. And this was called, before it happened, by William Z. Foster, an American Communist Party leader, in the book Toward Soviet America. So, to blame this on Hoover and Coolidge, presidents are told what to do, and they do it. If they get cranky and they don't like it, they don't get reelected, or they get spanked like Nixon and told, you know, take a hike. Sent to Park Ridge, New Jersey. I can't think of anything worse. Or if they put up a real big fuss, they get killed. Hoover, at the time, also backed a compulsory unionization for railway labor and recommended that American business organize itself into industry-wide cartel-like trade associations. We are passing, he said, from a period of extremely individualistic action into a period of associational activities. When the disaster struck in 1929, the country was intellectually disarmed. There were no prominent voices to name the disaster's cause. The Great Depression was not the result of a free market, but of controls. The economic dislocations which led to the collapse were a product of the government intervention of the preceding decades. A few men in the 30s, speaking for the remnant of the classical tradition, try to point this out. They did not, however, offer any comprehensive or philosophic approach to the issues. They were concerned mostly with details of current legislation, and their viewpoint was thoroughly ignored. The disaster created by controls was widely ascribed to the free market. On this point, the Hoover Republicans and the liberal intellectuals were in agreement. President Hoover responded to the crisis by preaching individualism, while at the same time clinging to the earlier controls and urging more government action, including massive public works, welfare programs at the state and local levels, farm price supports, and emergency loans to business. Hoover's policy was historic. It defined a new role for the government, which has been accurately described by Walter Lippmann, who writes, "It was Mr. Hoover who abandoned the principles of laissez-faire in relation to the business cycle and established the conviction that prosperity and depression can be publicly controlled by political action." Hoover's policy, like Bruning's in Germany, did not work. The soup kitchens and the desperation spread. The intellectuals stated their conclusions. The cause of the misery, declared Charles Beard, is, quote, the individualist creed. The task before us, then, is not to furbish up an old slogan, but to get rid of it. The intellectuals had long condemned the American system and the ideas in which it was based. They had their own creed, their own anti-materialistic ideals, and their own ambitions. To such men, the Great Depression was a godsend. To the writers and artists, and this is a quote, I'll figure out who it's from later, who had grown up in the big business era and had always resented its barbarism, its crowding out of everything they cared about. These years were not depressing, but stimulating, wrote Edmund Wilson. One couldn't help being exhilarated at the sudden, unexpected collapse of that stupid, gigantic fraud. It gave us a new sense of freedom, and it gave us a new sense of power. All right, that was lifted from Beard's The Myth of Rugged American Individualism. All right, now I'll end it. We're going to have one more segment, and we'll be done with it. And the reason I want to pull up the reins on some of this also is because, I'm sorry, but, you know, Peikoff, and if you want to read about it, you can. But he's, you know, what do I mean by they don't get it? For those of you who've been around for quite some time, there's no need to explain. For others, you know, you better take a look around, because it isn't individuals who decide to change the course of nature. They are told to do so. They are supplied to do so. They are backed to do so. It has been a very, very much a scripted existence for time immemorial. Now, the thing is, look at our country. Yes, we've had it better than most. But again, I mean, I'm not saying the muckrakers involved in this weren't really heartfelt wanting to see changes made. And I believe that their motivation and their efforts were completely pure, as much as human being can be pure. And I believe that probably if they didn't cause that much of a stir, if they didn't rake up that much muck, then corporations who, honestly, I mean, take a look at it. What is their default program? You know, what is it that courses through their veins? What is it that they're based on? And that is barbarism. It's true. It's brutality. Get the most out of what you can, pay the least, profit the most, and throw away the husk of whatever's left of your workers when the time is done. But still in all, whatever controls are on human beings in a government system should be also employed against corporations. Because in court, we are both called persons. You, I, and others. And we are lumped together with corporations as persons. But those persons get a whole lot more breaks than we do. And that's what I'm saying to you right now. Now, take a look at where we're at. We're not coming back. People think we're going to go through some kind of nadir for a while, and all of a sudden we're going to come roaring back in a new aeon of, like, American vibrancy and rugged individualism. It's over, man. The powers that be have decided that it's time for us to leave the field, but not before we get into one more war. And it's been going on forever. You know, if you don't like this, you know, then be angry at the sun, as Robinson Jefferson would say, because that's just the way the world goes round. If you think presidents make a difference, you're out of your mind. Presidents are picked because they are the ones who are best suited, or so it's felt, to go ahead and implement another plank in this platform that is a hangman's platform for you and me and everyone else. You know, that's something that Peikoff doesn't get. I mean, I understand, you know, he did a great work, and he's calling what is happening right now. But he also believes that people are the ones that come up with this stuff, and they're the ones that change the course of history. They do not. And this country scammed its people, its unwashed masses, right from the very beginning when the founding fathers got together, founding framers, got together and overthrew what was supposed to be kind of shored up. You can laugh at the Articles of Confederation, but you better puke at the Constitution, because Beard got it right when he said it wasn't for us. It was to protect their asses, and you better believe it. All right, that's it for now. Sorry for that pontification. I'll pick this up some other time. It's just been, I don't know, it's been a couple of days of just watching lunacy amongst we, the masses, and it just kind of got to me. So we'll finish up with Ominous Parallels next time. See you then.